A band of Starfleet renegades threatens to sabotage the peace.
Do you deny that the Federation is engaging in organized terrorist activities?
And spark an explosive conflict.
So they don't have a right to defend themselves?
They've crossed the line.
Now, Sisko must expose the engineers of this devious plan.
They've managed to start their own little war out here.
Or face a full-scale attack.
I just know they have to be stopped.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
And now, we don't have a conundrum this week, Tyler. This is a two-parter throwback episode. We're going to talk about the two-parter The Maquis from Deep Space Nine's second season.
Well, here's the conundrum. Why would anybody watch this two-parter after seeing it for the first time, Cam?
Because they don't remember it?
Okay.
But before we get into The Maquis, I just want to actually acknowledge the passing of a friend of the podcast just recently, and that's Mr. Don Marshall.
Yeah.
Who was a guest star on the original series. He played Boma in the episode Galileo 7. Now... we don't usually memorialize, you know, fallen Star Trek guest stars or cast members on the show too often, but this one was kind of a little special because he actually interacted with the two of us in a very memorable encounter in Las Vegas a couple years ago.
Yeah, we saw him on his panel at the Las Vegas convention back in 2015, and we happened to encounter him later on that day in the hallways, and I couldn't help but just go up and tell him how great it was to see him up there and what a fan I was of his. And he said that made him feel very good inside.
I was starstruck.
You were, yeah.
Which was weird because I'd encountered other, you know, Star Trek stars who were a lot more prominent to me. You know, like meeting Nana Visitor, Rene Auberjonois, Shatner. I feel like I was somehow more composed than meeting Don Marshall.
Why is that, Cam?
I have no idea. Maybe it was the surprise factor because we just kind of ran into him in the lobby of a hotel. Maybe that's what it was.
And he was happy to chat, you know, go more so than other actors we've encountered.
That too. And I remember I just turned into like a sputtering idiot because I just said I just said, I'm a big fan of that episode you were on.
Yeah.
The most vague compliment perhaps he's ever gotten in his life.
I'm sure he's heard worse.
But it was like, I don't know why I said that. It's like, I know the Galileo 7. I know the character he played. I could have had some sort of intelligent question to ask or something. Nope, nothing.
Well, at least he got my flattery, and I'm sure that's all he'll remember.
You made him feel good.
I did.
But yeah, it was kind of sad just to see him passing this last week. And just a, you know, another reminder to everyone who goes to cons or whatever, go and meet some of these older stars if you get the opportunity. A lot of them aren't that expensive to meet, and you just never know if, like, the next day they're gone.
Yeah, it could be your last chance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, hopefully all the stars that appeared in this episode of Deep Space Nine, may they have decades more of these conventions to go to.
They're hoping not.
Well, but we're tackling the Maquis here, and this is a bit of a unique episode in that not only is it a two-part episode for Deep Space Nine, but... it's tasked with establishing a lot of lore.
Yeah.
Of course, we're tackling the Maquis here that go on to, I guess, crew about a third of Voyager when that show goes to premiere about, what, a year later after this? Maybe 9 months?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we have to figure out who the Maquis are. Their background. They do a lot of that on Next Generation as well, with regards to Ro Laren, as well as Wesley Crusher, when we talk about the Demilitarized Zone and the colonies there that are being turned over to the Cardassians.
Yeah, well, the Maquis were created specifically for Voyager, but they felt like they had to, instead of having to explain who the Maquis were in the pilot of that episode, and, you know, a Caretaker... they felt it would be a better idea to establish them in Deep Space Nine and Next Gen in advance, so it just spared them all that heavy lifting.
But I do recall that in the pilot of Voyager that they do have, like, a Star Wars-esque sort of crawl across the screen that explains exactly who the Maquis are.
Right.
Would that 30-second crawl across the screen be a better option for somebody who has no idea what Maquis are, or should they go ahead and watch this entire two-part episode, Cam?
I think I might recommend this two-part episode.
Okay, okay. Well, why don't we get into it? What,
Tyler, what were your first thoughts on this when you saw it originally?
You know what? So, true story. I believe I actually saw part two in first run back in the day.
Okay.
I never saw part one until, I believe, like, reruns? So my memories of this are kind of fragmented, and I think a lot of maybe some of the blanks are filled in by my Star Trek encyclopedia, and the fact that going into Voyager, I actually knew quite a bit about the Maquis just from doing my own research. I had like this old edition of TV Guide that explained a lot of it
right
ahead of time, so I felt totally fine going into Voyager knowing who the Maquis were, even after only seeing part two ahead of time. So my reaction to part two at the time, I was like, okay.
not a passionate
I did adoration. Not say, oh, wow, this deserves a spin-off series. So, Cam, what was your first reaction, response to seeing Maquis parts one and two just a few short years ago?
So, yeah, this would have been about, I guess, 2011. It's funny, like, I have no memory of watching it. Really none.
You know what, I should say, really my strongest memory of this is Ben throwing the bag on the table and his pal Calvin Hudson shooting it and vaporizing it, essentially.
For me, Bernie Casey was what I remembered.
Yeah.
Like, the second he walks on screen, I'm like, okay, this all rings a bell, but for me, when I remember my earliest memories of watching Deep Space Nine, I remember a lot of the kind of the quirkier standalone episodes, like Move Along Home or If Wishes Were Horses, things like that. But then also great episodes like Duet. But to me, in my mind, I remember the moment where Deep Space Nine really crystallized into what Deep Space Nine is was actually the finale of season two with Frank Langella, the three-parter.
No, that would actually be the premiere of season two.
Oh, is it the premiere?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's interesting then, because, yeah, that's where it all kind of crystallizes for me. But for some reason, this did not stick out. And when I think of the Maquis, Eddington is where that storyline, at least looking back at the series, was where it really became interesting to me.
Well, okay, we can hold off a little bit, but when we get into Voyager, but I think Deep Space Nine did a lot more interesting things with the Maquis than Voyager ever did.
What? What are you talking about?
But the thing is, I don't know if this is a great start to the Maquis myself.
This was a lot of backstory, a lot of explaining, but I actually think it has some solid quality. So let's get into what works.
Sure.
So, Tyler, what worked for you?
Well, I liked a lot of the smaller moments in particular. We start this episode off with Kira and Jadzia talking all about their dates and the kind of partner that they're into. And I think it's actually the first reference to Captain Baudet, who has the transparent skull. He's one of the best, running jokes that this series has. Personally, I can't wait until we see one of his species perhaps show up in, say, Star Trek Discovery, if they have essentially the production budget to afford depicting an alien with a transparent skull.
Do you think they will ever show one?
You know, would that take away some of the mystique?
Yeah.
You know, is our own imaginations better than whatever special effects it conjure up?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. If they do, if one of these species, what are they, Gridarian or something?
I'm going to go with that.
Sure. If a shows up on Discovery, I'm not going to be upset, but I'm okay with just using my imagination to fill in the blanks here.
What about a Baudet spinoff?
I think I mentioned him in our potential spinoff episode there, yeah.
Good, good.
So, okay, but not to be, not to diminish this episode. I like the smaller moments,
That is a good one, though. I like the banter between the two of them.
Yeah.
And it actually gave me a real reminder, because I'm actually going back, and I've just finished season one of Deep Space Nine, and I've been revisiting a lot of it. And to me, a lot of it is rediscovering sort of the things I love about sort of the series, because when you finish Deep Space Nine, I feel like you just take away sort of a real appreciation for the arcs and the characters. Oh, but yeah. Going back is much more about watching all the little moments, all the little dynamics, and how important they are.
And how it maybe adds up into something greater, you know, yes. later on.
Yes, exactly. And I really love moments like this because they're just these moments of, like, really warm character dynamics that I think is what, you know, it's one of those sort of unspoken heroes of the show is that these little moments are what make you really latch on to the characters in a big way so that when it gets more dramatic and sweeping, you're so much more invested.
Yeah, and, you know, something that I believe came up in part two that I don't know would have registered with people at the time, but when Odo was talking about how he would control the station if he was given full authority,
mm-hmm.
He's like, give me more deputies, allow me to institute a curfew, allow me to conduct more searches. I think that's Iris Steubenbeer telegraphing Odo's lineage as a founder.
Right
there, you know, how the founders are all about control and a certain rigidity there. And I think it's very fascinating. At the time, you would have thought, oh, it's just Odo's characteristic. He's a one-of-a-kind species. But watching it again, I'm just like, no, this is Iris Steubenbeer saying, oh, no way, we've got something up our sleeves in a few episodes from here when we reveal that Odo is, in fact, you know, one of the founders or part of the founder species of the Dominion.
Right.
So one other thing that jumps out to me, for part one, David Livingston directed that episode. Mm-hmm. I often find the directing in Star Trek episodes to be kind of bland, and I actually enjoyed the directing for this one. Did you notice there's a lot of, like, one-shots throughout this one? And
some interesting angles, too.
Yeah, just even coming from, like, Dukat's boot,
mm-hmm.
you know, to start off one. There's, like, just long periods where the camera would never cut. You have Quark and this Vulcan Maquis terrorist or freedom fighter, however you want to.
How dare you?
Well, you know, I'll digress very in just a moment, but just to finish off that last thought.
Yeah.
You'll have, like, the camera just stick on two characters for a long period of time, never cutting away. They did that again with Ben and Dukat in the runabout. It's stuff that I really dug. But going back to kind of that freedom fighter versus terrorist discussion, we get a lot of play with that with Kira, her whole role as part of the resistance. Do you think they really used it to the best degree that they could have, that philosophical question?
I felt they didn't in part one. I thought that the introduction of the Maquis element actually really yielded some really interesting dynamics between characters. I wrote down in my notes, like, there's a lot of tension in part one. Not because we really care maybe that much about the Maquis plot, and, you know, what blew up the Cardassian ship, but you do have, like, these dynamics between, like, Hudson and Sisko.
Yeah.
Their argument over this treaty. And how Hudson feels it's a bad treaty, and Sisko feels he's on the Federation side about it. You have Sisko and Dukat quarreling over it. You have Kira and Sisko quarreling. And then you also have that moment you mentioned, Odo, and Kira jumps in and is angry about it.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think Ben is on the side that he's on because he's a man in the uniform, or because he genuinely believes that the Federation is in the right?
He's definitely for the uniform.
Yeah.
That is an excellent question.
And I don't think they ever really dig into that.
Part of me thinks he's on the side of the Federation because he doesn't quite know enough details to take a side.
But I'll give you a great quote, and it's one that Iris Steubenbeer recited at this year's convention in Las Vegas. But Ben Sisko in part two does say, "It's easy to be a saint in paradise."
Mm-hmm.
And of course he's talking about how, look, if you're at Starfleet Command, you look outside the window and everything's perfect. And, you know, so it's very easy to have all these ideals. If you're in a very kind of conflict-ridden zone, like, say, the demilitarized zone, can you really abide by those ideals of the Federation when, you know, maybe the Federation isn't even there to back you up so much? And so I do see that internal conflict within Ben, but I don't know if it's explored really to its full potential.
I don't know that there is a clean-cut answer for how to end his sort of arc over these two episodes.
Yeah.
He has to take a side, so he takes the side he does in ultimately trying to stop his friend from attacking a Cardassian weapons depot, but it's sort of not even really... Those are threads left dangling in the wind at the end of it. Yeah, I just wonder if the writers were like, and to be fair, I think it adds to a certain element of Deep Space Nine in general, which is that there's no easy answers.
Yeah.
I don't know that that leads to a particularly dramatic two-parter.
Yeah, let's maybe skip to the end here. What did you think of the conclusion of the episode?
I was going to save that for what doesn't work.
Okay, well, you know, before we get there, let's jump into what works for you in this episode, Cameron.
I want to talk about Bernie Casey as Calvin Hudson.
Yeah.
I think he's fantastic in this episode. I love that he's sort of like Sisko. He's sort of this career Starfleet guy, but he looks like he's seen some things. He doesn't have that sort of TNG sort of Superman quality, you know?
Sure.
He looks kind of...
He's no Ronnie Cox. That's Superman quality that Ronnie Cox possesses. Yes, one Captain Jellicoe.
But a lot of the TNG characters, Starfleet characters, looked kind of like... They never looked like they'd really experienced a lot of trials and tribulations in their work.
Yeah.
They always seem very composed. Whereas what I like about Hudson is that he just seems like he's kind of been through some tough times. And, like, Sisko and him can relate to each other, but you get the sense, like, their journey hasn't been that easy.
Yeah, and they definitely have some bonding about, I think, their shared, traumas,
mm-hmm.
if you want to say that. And they also have some bonding over their thoughts about Jadzia Dax. it's no longer Curzon boys, and they get pretty creepy for her a little while. Cam, what did you think of that scene?
There's a pretty amazing comedic beat, and I don't know if it was intended to be comedic.
I don't think it was. But
where,
like,
Calvin Hudson is kind of, you know, Ben just kind of shoots down the idea of him and Jadzia being together. It's like, oh, it's still Dax. And Hudson's like, yeah, that would be strange. And it just leaves this beat of awkwardness that you and I both were like howling with laughter.
Yeah.
Do you think it was intended as a comedic beat?
No, but I do think the writers were trying to acknowledge something that maybe a lot of people were thinking about. You know, mm-hmm. like, look, Jadzia and Ben have this very close relationship, and I don't for an instance ever picked up Ben ever having any sort of attraction to her,
mm-hmm.
and I'm glad that they addressed that, though.
Right.
You know.
Interestingly, though, that scene comes not very long at all after the one of Kira and Jadzia talking about... The love interest that Jadzia has.
Captain Baudet.
Yeah, so it's, you have these dueling sort of talks about the opposite sex. I think Kira's and Dax's is maybe better written.
Yeah, it's certainly not creepy. Yeah. Although,
at least they didn't drop the term old man's fantasy.
Well, what did you think about Kira disparaging Jadzia for being willing to date a Ferengi?
It was very racist.
It was, you know.
Do you think they would ever put that in a new Star Trek series?
No, you know, and it's going to be interesting how they tackle this, because if you go back and watch a lot of these Star Trek episodes, you find that there's a lot of prejudice and racism mm-hmm. from, like, the hero characters.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, those Klingons, they smell funny.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I don't know how much of that is really going to translate 20 years later to current-day audiences. Cam, you and I were having a discussion about Cheers just before we started playing this episode
this
evening. And I know all listeners are here for our Cheers podcast. But I was intrigued by watching, like, season one, which was, like, almost 35 years ago. And they're
God, really?
1982.
Oh, my God, I'm so old and broken.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so depressing.
But they're trying to tackle homophobia in the bar. And... And for a series that I've been going through all of season one, and I feel that it held up quite well, but for something like homophobia at the bar, it just did not hold up well. Mm. The characters came off as very dated, and a lot of these, like, great characters that you know and love, you find out they're all homophobes.
Right.
It's just like, ooh, okay. I definitely think, you know, you go to Star Trek and with Discovery, there's going to have some catching up to do.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to be a big deal. You know, it's not going to be... I don't think that they're going to be so on the nose with a lot of the catching up that they have to do.
It will be interesting to see how they tackle that theme, because I'm getting the sense Klingons are a major part of this series.
Yeah.
And if you have Klingon intermingling with members of the crew, I mean, it's going to naturally bring racism into the question or into the discussion.
Yeah, well, former showrunner slash current paycheck cashier Brian Fuller.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, he has since stepped down as showrunner for Star Trek Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Read into that what you may. He said one of the big inspirations of this episode is of this series is Balance of Terror from season one of the original series, which deals a lot with racism.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely
what he means by that is every episode is going to end with a character walking down the hallway looking tired.
I think that was obvious.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I definitely think, you know, kind of the issues of racism, they're going to be dealt with in just like prejudice. Mm-hmm. Maybe prejudice more than racism.
Right.
They'll be dealt with. I don't think we're going to get comments again like, ooh, you had dated Ferengi?
That said, I feel like if any character on Deep Space Nine can say that, and we kind of accepted it's Kira, because there is sort of that hardened edge to her and sure. Sort of the really, really awful upbringing.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect it to come from, say, Dr. Bashir.
No.
Or Jadzia.
Right. Maybe so. Quark.
Yeah.
But...
Or if it's in reference to a Cardassian, maybe Miles, but...
I feel like Cardassians, people get a free pass on the series.
Fair enough. Okay.
All too often, it seems.
Well, Cam, what else works for you in this particular two-parter?
For me, I mean, I think the introduction of the idea of the Maquis works. I think it establishes them quite well. Like, this was an episode knowing kind of its place or its intention to essentially establish who the Maquis are.
Yeah.
I think it does a decent job tying it into a story that is at least interesting. And I think... Oh, he's laughing.
Okay.
But I think, honestly, the genius of this two-parter, and I'm going to say genius... is that they use it as an excuse to develop the character of Gul Dukat and his relationship with Sisko.
Oh, yeah.
We spend a ton of time with Dukat, and this episode is actually acknowledged as being the one that really introduces ambiguity into his character. He was previously usually portrayed more as just a villain.
Yeah.
Whereas in this case, he's kind of an uneasy ally, and this is, the beginning of sort of that feeling I get watching Deep Space Nine, where I so much want Dukat to just... get along with everyone, you know, because he's so awesome. Mark Alaimo is amazing. And he has like a scene in this where he's telling like a captain of another ship to stand down and let them aboard. That is a great iconic character moment. Maybe Dukat's first amazing moment in Deep Space Nine, quite possibly.
Yeah.
And it's just the path of so many great things to come. Start really here.
Well, it's also very interesting to see what a fully formed character he was, even from Emissary. You know, and I don't think it's because of lack of character growth, but I think Mark Alaimo just, like, nailed the character out of the gate. And just to see him get layers added to him in episodes like this, I think this is a great Ben/Dukat showcase. What do you think is the best... Sisko Dukat showcase episode. I'm going to give it to Waltz, personally.
Oh, I think Waltz is the best one. Yeah. That's the one that pops to my mind, too.
So, it's no slouch when it comes to that particular category of episodes, though.
No, I mean, you know, in this episode, Dukat gets kidnapped by the Maquis. We're invested in them getting Dukat back.
Yes.
Which, I mean, how many series or movies, if, you know, the awful, awful Hitler-like villain was kidnapped, that we'd be like, boy, I hope they save him?
Well, that's just kind of the genius of the writing that,
yes.
You know, you are invested in this.
Mm-hmm.
Even the parts where, like, they do rescue Dukat, and he keeps telling Sisko and crew to shoot his kidnappers.
Yes.
And they don't do it. He's like, come on, guys, just do it.
Yes.
You know, it's entertaining.
Like, we are kind of cheering, even uncomfortably, for Dukat, even in a two-parter where he twice punches out a woman.
Yeah, what do you think was up with that? Of course, the woman we're speaking about is his Vulcan kidnapper.
Yeah, Sakota, played by Bertilla DeMoss, who looks a lot like Sean Young.
Sure.
Yeah.
But
yeah, twice, because there's the scene initially where they try to kidnap him, and a whole group of Maquis grab onto him. He punches her in the face, and she hits the ground, and then he gets phased. That's the only person he punches in that group.
Yeah.
Not the guy in the dorky red vest. And then later, when they're in these caves and they're saving Dukat, he again punches her in the face. Is this a conscious decision? I mean, like, why...
On the part of the writers?
Yes, like, why in two different scenes is Dukat only punching out one character?
Well,
and this is part one and part two.
it is kind of strange because we know that Vulcans are, like, very strong,
yeah.
much stronger than humans, so are we trying to say that Cardassians are even stronger, or... I've never known Cardassians for their strength.
No, they're photographic memories, though.
Yeah, I forgot about that until I saw this
You know
episode.
Who didn't forget about it? Cardassians.
Good,
I'm here all week, folks.
Good one. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that, but it seems very targeted.
It's an odd choice, and I would love to ask Mark Alimo about this or something.
Yeah. How do you get in the mode for, like, punching a colleague in the face?
It's weird, because it feels intentional to me.
Right.
Like, I mean, when they're directing...
Maybe Mark Alimo is just improvising.
We'll have to ask him about that.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's other... It's not even like she's the only developed McKee character in the episode. There's others. Like, he could have scuffled with the guy in the red vest.
Okay, let's go to the vest conversation for a moment here. Why is it every single McKee member has to wear a vest?
So this is what works?
Yes. I'm curious. Because we're introduced to them here, and then they pick up with the vest motif in Voyager. I'll say this. The costume designer, was it Blackman? Does that ring a bell?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, he seems to be very obsessed with vests in the 24th century as well.
What do you think it is about the McKee that scream vests?
Is some sort of utility aspect to it?
Is it because they have their sleeves rolled up? Like, Starfleet are always looking formal with these uniforms, whereas the McKee are kind of like the... you know, sort of the quote-unquote, like, farmers or people of the earth. They've got their sleeves rolled up. Vests would, you know, free up their arms, essentially, for work.
Yeah.
I guess?
Sure.
That's the best I got.
But you'd think that they'd have at least pocketed vests
mm-hmm.
that you could keep tools in or spades, because they're farmers, of course.
You know what my issue with the McKee is? And it's such a superficial thing, but the McKee have never looked cool. They always look kind of dorky.
Yeah.
And that goes not just for this two-parter. This goes for Chakotay when we see him in, you know, Caretaker. There's something about the McKee outfits that just don't scream like, oh, man, that's a really cool group.
Well, okay, let's go to Journey's End, and they kind of establish...
No, please don't.
well, in that next-gen episode, it's Wesley's... Swan Song episode, in which...
And the Travelers.
Yes. How could I forget about the Traveler?
Yeah.
But
he doesn't forget about you.
No. But they established that planet with the, I guess, Native Americans living on it. And we do see that carried on here in the McKee with... We do have that one background player who's of Aboriginal descent, and he is wearing some, I guess, contemporary... Or traditional Aboriginal gear.
Right.
And plus a sort of Maquis outfit. What I'm getting at here, though, is just how they carry that on to Chakotay. They cast Robert Beltran, who's not of Aboriginal descent. I guess, you know, he's Chicano.
Mm-hmm.
But then Robert Beltran says, yeah, they never had a grasp on it, so they just called me a rubber tree person.
Yeah.
So I don't. It's just interesting journey that how they started and where they got to with Robert Beltran as Maquis members. They really wanted to emphasize that it had to do with a lot of, you know, these natives being pushed off their land, essentially. So yeah, very on the nose, you know. But Star Trek usually isn't very subtle, you know.
No, but that actually makes a really interesting parallel between Kira and her sympathies with the Maquis.
Yeah.
Because if we look at the Deep Space Nine as sort of a Western in space, Kira sort of represents the Aboriginals that were mistreated.
Yeah, do you think they explored it well enough? Maybe the parallels between Kira and the Maquis. They definitely have her, you know...
Sympathizing with them.
And yeah. She had some conflict there with, you know... Cisco, to the point where I had no idea, but he had a button in his office where he could just push it and the door shows people out.
That's a great scene.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That might be among the... there's a handful of great scenes in this episode. That might be in my top... That's probably in my top three.
Yeah.
The other ones are probably Descartes moments.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that argument between the two of them is fantastic. And I kind of missed a bit in the second one where they kind of get on the same page, Kira and Ben. I would have liked more of a talk about why they're on the same page. Because they are not in that scene, and it's fiery.
Yeah.
Like, that, you can really feel the tension. Like, those actors are really chewing into that dialogue. And I feel like that, you know, for a season two episode, this is really digging into what makes Deep Space Nine special, which is the sort of conflict over philosophical and political issues that, you know, you would never see, like, Picard's, you know, really yelling at Riker about things.
No, absolutely not.
And then saying, you know, get out of my office.
Yeah. Or pushing a button and showing him the way out.
Exactly. And that's what makes this series special. So I feel like the McKee two-parter ultimately has a lot of the elements that are make Deep Space Nine what it is, especially compared to, you know, rewatching season one. I'm like, ooh, this is a lot different than I remembered it being. It's very kind of trying to just kind of do TNG stories.
Okay, so you bring up they have a lot of elements in here that make Deep Space Nine what it is. Maybe we can segue to what doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know if this is a very compelling episode or whether I'm really invested in the central conflict here, which is between Commander Hudson and Commander Sisko.
Yeah.
Cam, what does not work for you in this two-parter?
Well, for me, is the conclusion of it. I wanted more of an intense, basically final match between Sisko and Hudson.
Certainly got that with a character like Eddington.
Yes.
And who has, like, no history with Ben.
Did you notice we had, like, an Eddington clone in this episode?
Yes.
I called him Froddington.
Froddington. Oh, okay. That's great.
He's a tall, thin, bald man.
I
Starfleet member who...
Yeah, in my notes I called him Proto-Eddington.
Yeah.
Yes. I like Froddington much more. Though.
There's a few Proto-Eddingtons, because there's the one we talked about a couple episodes ago, maybe one episode ago, in the Losers episode, the early security chief who or security staff member who was quarreling with Odo in Move Along Home. And
hello, Constable Odo.
Yeah, I can't remember what his name was. But,
it doesn't matter.
Wasn't it like Bilpin or Bimpin or something like that?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. But he was sort of a Proto-Eddington that, you know, that the creators acknowledged. And then this guy is, like, even closer. It's, like, so much so, this guy might have been his body double.
Well, it was curious, because this guy, he was dressed in Eddington's uniform.
Yes.
And he looked a lot like him, but he turns out to be a farmer in disguise. Worst Transformer ever, by the way. Could you imagine buying those toys that your parents giving you farmers in disguise for Christmas? I'd be pretty choked.
You know that is not unlikely to show up in a Michael Bay movie, though.
Yeah. So we've got the Eddington clone. And, yeah, for me, I think I just had a tough time caring about, say, the motivation behind Commander Hudson. Like, I got it, you know, why he was invested, but did I really care so much to see it through to its conclusion? I was far more invested in the fate of Dekot after he was kidnapped.
Right, yeah, I agree. I think one of the big balls that are dropped in part two is actually not giving Hudson enough screen time.
Yeah.
I think in part one, they really do a good job building that relationship with Sisko, where I actually was quite invested in Hudson. I really thought that he was a character that I sympathized with and that I found interesting. A lot of the time when they would walk on these sort of other Starfleet guest stars, they weren't that interesting. You know, we did our Admirals episode quite a while ago. Admirals are so often boring. This guy is not an Admiral, he's a Commander, but he's someone who's a visiting Starfleet guest star, and he's, I think, really interesting. I was really hoping there would be much bigger stakes to his finale in the two-parter, because we do not see this character ever again.
Yeah.
And it sort of ends with this dangling thread of, well, maybe we'll see Hudson again. And we don't.
Yeah.
So, and it has a really clunky shootout sequence, and that's kind of the end of it.
Well, you bring up, we usually get these boring admirals that appear on. What did you think about the return of Admiral Nacheyev here in Deep Space Nine?
I'm always excited to see Nacheyev. Yeah. Nacheyev's a character I think is really underused in Berman era Trek.
I'm definitely surprised that, you know, between, you know, I guess we had one Admiral Ross start to appear season 5 of Deep Space Nine.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that, you know, for those first five seasons of Deep Space Nine, they didn't have an Acheyev appearing more often. I think she appeared maybe twice in all of Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why not just plug her in instead of, like, Blandy McBlanderson, you know, up until Admiral Ross came aboard?
And Acheyev, there's so much fireworks in that character. She would be an awesome character to have face off against Kira or Sisko. You know, I mean, we see it with Sisko here, but more with Sisko. You know, so many characters on the show would be really interesting. I would love to watch Kira and Acheyev have a disagreement over philosophical difference.
Yeah, look, Acheyev, she can dish it out just as well as Kira does. She called the Maquis irresponsible hotheads. Burn.
That's foul language from Starfleet.
Hey, well, she is a saint, Cam. Living in paradise.
Quite true.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because originally, Ira Stephen Bear wanted to kill Hudson at the end of this two-parter. And Michael Piller argued against it big time, won the disagreement, and so again, yeah, Hudson survives the end. And apparently when they were watching footage from it, Michael Piller was like, I was right.
Oh, okay.
So, was he right, Tyler?
Well, the fact that we never saw Hudson come again, then I think Michael Piller was wrong.
Yeah.
He was just kind of like, it's this dangling thread. He's like a Tom Riker, you know.
Right.
Where, of course, Tom Riker, we always had the promise that Kira would go rescue him from that Cardassian prison, and it just never came to be.
Right, and, you know, when you've got Bernie Casey, who's such a good actor, why not exploit that further down the road, especially when you have the Eddington stories? Why not bring him, Hudson, back? Because just like Sisko's loyalties, you can really feel, I think Avery Brooks is fantastic in this two-parter, but you can really feel how he's torn between his life, you know, who knows how many years, but long, long-term friend, and his dedication to Starfleet and the Federation. And so I would have loved to have seen that exploited further with Hudson, because I think this character, there's so much potential that is just not carried through.
I just wonder if he didn't want to return to the series, they made overtures, or maybe his asking price was too much. But honestly, I still get this sense that maybe by the end of it, the character is a little played out. Like, I don't know if the writers, producers got to the end of Maquis Part 2 and were like, oh, we've got a top 10 episode right here that's going to go down in all-time Star Trek lore.
I don't know. It seems like the creators were pretty loved this episode quite a lot. They were pretty enthusiastic about it. It's really showing the early glimmers of what the series was.
Is this from
Ira Stephen Bear, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so this was viewed as a very important episode, and originally it was actually intended as a Shane homage.
Sure.
And then it somehow wound up as this. Ira Stephen Bear had a funny quote where he's like, yeah, it was originally going to be like a Shane sort of homage. I don't know what we were thinking.
Yeah, I just wonder if I can look at DS9 as a whole and see the heights that they reach.
Yeah.
Where you get a two-part episode like the Maquis. I think by the time we get to the end of it, our run of two-part episodes in Deep Space Nine, I don't know if the Maquis is going to be in the top half of these two-part episodes.
But for early seasons of Deep Space Nine, how do you think the Maquis stacks up?
And I think that's a very good question, because I think when you go from the series that was just trying to imitate Next Generation a lot of the time for its first season, and then it really starts to come into its own. Because at the time that the Maquis aired, I wasn't a DS9 fan at all, really.
Yeah.
And I was pretty young. I was very much into Next Generation, and I didn't even bother watching Part 1 when it first aired. It was only Part 2. So, you know, like, to me, I did not have full appreciation of it coming into its own at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go back and rewatch it, it's already from the perspective of having seen another 170-some episodes of Deep Space Nine and knowing what it can do. So, to me, the Maquis does not really stand out to me as a phenomenal entry. I don't think it's a bad episode. I just think, as you alluded to, Cam, earlier, it's very forgettable, because you didn't really remember it. I didn't particularly remember it. And if it's a bad episode, it's hard to forget those.
Right.
This is maybe just more damning, where it's just somewhat forgettable.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's funny, though, like, watching it now, I did have more appreciation, just having revisited season one, where the serialization in season one is pretty spotty for the most part. Mm-hmm. But when you do get payoffs or whatever, storylines continuing, it's things like Kyle Paca coming back and like being dying and rising from the grave to like go live in a prison colony for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, what am I watching? Like, this is not good. So when I see something like this, this is kind of like this is not the heights, you know, like, I think when we get to The Search part one and two, like, that's a much stronger two-parter.
Yeah.
maybe not past tense. but,
I'm not looking forward to rewatching that.
No. But, like, that to me is where Deep Space Nine, you know, gets the ball rolling as to what it's good at. But I feel like this early stab is actually reasonably effective. I think it shows the series figuring out what it is, and I think it's a like, this is kind of like the B grade, you know, start. It's not a, you're not opening, hitting a home run, but it's a solid double for me.
Well, what, how do you think this stacks up versus next gen, two-parters in terms of having like a, 90-minute standalone story?
Yeah.
Does this, do you need to have a lot of knowledge of the Star Trek universe to enjoy an episode like Maquis?
Yeah, I think you do.
Yeah.
I don't think this is a friendly episode just for newcomers to start with. I can't imagine anyone starting with this. Like, yeah. To me, this one actually reminds me a bit of Redemption, the Klingon story.
Okay.
Now, you know, we can make arguments back and forth over which is better. I mean, in the sense of, like, they feel fairly small. They're not like the grand dramatic two-parters like Best of Both Worlds or, Chain of Command. It's just sort of a low, sort of political two-parter that ends in kind of a clunky spaceship battle. And it doesn't like end with a bang. It's sort of, there's ramifications that will go forward from that two-parter, but you don't, you know, walk out of that one like, wow, now that was a sweeping story.
I think another important similarity is how much lore is hanging mm-hmm. on them. Not Data's brother, but just, you know.
Yeah. He's here all week, folks, too.
But just the fact that, you know, they built up Redemption with a lot of this Klingon lore, and with this is kind of the Alpha Quadrant Cardassian demilitarized zone sort of lore that this is hanging on as well. So,
do you think they looked at Redemption when they were planning this?
No.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. Okay. I bet their objective every time is just to do something special. You know, I really honestly think, I wonder if part of my problem with this episode, because I think you can tell listeners that I'm not the biggest fan of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if it's hampered by the fact that this was meant to be as kind of a setting the table in anticipation of Voyager's launch.
And, yeah, no kidding.
So And I don't think it was an episode. I think Voyager could have completely just gone on with Caretaker without ever previously establishing the Maquis.
Yeah.
But the fact that they do establish the Maquis in Deep Space Nine, and we get some really great storylines out of it. Like you said, we have Eddington. We also have everything going on with Cassidy Yates.
Yeah.
Tom Riker, you know, just think about everything that comes out of it. We even get the point where the Maquis are all eliminated.
Right.
And that eventually is acknowledged on Voyager, like way down the road after they establish contact with the Alpha Quadrant. But, you know, I definitely dig what the Maquis grew into after being established in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a bit about that, because I think that's an interesting element to bring up, is, you know, Deep Space Nine's handling of the Maquis, I feel like it's far, far richer than anything Voyager does.
Well, Voyager, they establish the Maquis, and then Tuvok goes and runs around the corridor with them in sweatpants. And yeah. Do they really do much else with the Maquis?
No, and that's the fascinating thing, because when I watch this episode, I get a sense of the passion behind the Maquis cause. Like, that this is something that, like Kira as a resistance cell member, you know, like, this is something that is so intensely important to them that they will die for it. When you get to Voyager, do you ever get the sense Chakotay was willing to die for this cause?
No. I don't think anybody. The closest we get is Lon Suter, who just likes killing people.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I find it really fascinating how, while the Maquis were created essentially for Voyager, Voyager probably does them the worst.
Voyager does nothing with them.
Is there really anything? Okay, when I think of the Maquis on Voyager, I think of, obviously, the pilot, which introduces, you know, Chakotay and B'Elanna Torres as Maquis members, and Tuvok as an undercover one.
Tom is a failed Maquis operator.
There you go, yeah. And then I also think of the episode where they're running that simulation program for what would happen if the Maquis, like, rebelled and tried to take over the ship.
Yeah, worst case scenario.
Thank you, yeah. So, other than that, that's about all I got.
Don't forget Tuvok and sweatpants.
Well, I never
learning, did. Learning curve is the probably... Do you think that goes down as one of the worst season finales ever?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, Turnabout Intruder's no gem. Or Assignment Earth.
I would rather watch those two than than Learning Curve. Just watching Tuvok run around in sweatpants with wayward Maquis officers who...
he learned them good.
Yeah. Run!
Well, it's so fascinating to me. Like, why do you think it is that they put so much effort into establishing so much about the Maquis here, and that passion is drained out of them in Voyager?
Well, you know, Ron Moore commented on this after he had this big, long interview with Cinescape magazine, maybe about a year after he quit the Voyager writing staff.
And right.
He said it was just bizarre to him that as soon as they establish Caretaker, they put all the Maquis officers in Starfleet uniforms. And he's like, well, what was the point of that, you know?
That was apparently a fight Michael Piller had. He wanted it to be half and half, like half of them not, you know, wearing Maquis uniforms, essentially, or outfits, and he lost that battle.
It's a battle I think he really should have fought even harder for, and maybe he did. And,
yeah.
You know, but it was really, I don't... Yeah, Voyager, you did not do the Maquis justice based on everything that was set up for you.
No, no. And there was some acknowledgement. I can't remember who it was that said it, but basically acknowledged later was like, you know, I think Deep Space Nine was the true owner of the Maquis.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that.
Not Next Gen either. Well, Ensign Ro, we still love you.
Yeah. Was Cito Jaxo, was she... she wasn't a Maquis member, but she had to go on, like, this infiltration mission, is that? Am I remembering
that correctly? That rings well, yeah.
Okay. I think that was maybe the second to last episode of the series, or... Is that Preemptive Strike, I believe?
I believe so, yeah. That does ring a bell.
Way back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
So is there anything... Or wait.
am I getting her mixed up with Ro Laren? Was Ro in Preemptive Strike, or is that Cito Jaxa?
That I don't remember.
Okay, well, you know, you caught me. Yeah. I'm having a bit of a brain fart right now. I apologize.
Definitely not a Cardassian.
No, definitely not.
So is there anything else about this episode, anything of note to you that jumped out when you were watching it?
Well, yeah. How old is Kira Nerys supposed to be?
That's an interesting question, because
she said that she lived, you know, for 26 years with the Cardassians before the Liberation came. So, are they saying that the Liberation came, you know, as soon as they retook, you know, a lot of the, say, Deep Space Nine, a lot of the infrastructure back? Because I think they established Next Generation that the Cardassians had already stripped Bajor of its resources, or maybe they're just showing Bajoran refugees. But to me, I'm very uncertain about how old Kira is supposed to be at this point. The other thing is Gul Dukat was, they established here that he was, the prefect for 10 years?
Right.
So, I don't know. Yeah, that jumped out to me.
Well, and we know that Dukat had an affair with Kira's mother.
Right.
So...
And how old is Kira supposed to be at the time? Was Kira supposed to be like...
12? 12, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. So is Kira in her late 20s?
I think here, Kira's supposed to be maybe her mid-20s.
I'll buy it.
Sure.
I got no disagreements.
Nana Visitor is, what, 40?
I think she's in her late 30s.
I think she may be at youngest 38.
Yeah.
So, hey, I'm not complaining. I buy it.
The There's one moment, actually, that I should have mentioned earlier when we talked about great character dynamics. I think there's a fantastic Quark scene in this two-parter, in part two, to be specific.
Sure, yeah.
Where he has the talk with Sakota about peace and how it's, you know, really, like, it's too expensive to keep fighting this ongoing battle between the Maquis and the Cardassians, and that peace, it's the time to make the deal to broker peace because it's the least cost. Yeah. I love how he's, you know, we're getting sort of this argument for peace through the sensibilities of a Ferengi, looking at it from the point of view of profit. Like, you know, this is where we really get to see how well the Ferengi are written on Deep Space Nine.
Well, and even think, flash forward a few seasons where he and Cousin Gala team up and are selling arms.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely has some very conflicted feelings when it comes to the profitability of armed conflict.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it's fun to see him in this sort of really walking into the, you know, stepping into the gray territory in this episode, because often Quark's antics were a little more just mischievous. I like when they took him places that were darker.
Yeah.
Like, he was, you know, theoretically going to cost lives.
You know, yeah, and I was surprised. They go down that road with Quark a lot, and there's never any consequences.
Well, he was left in that prison cell, quote-unquote, forever.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, like, all the scenes with Quark in the brig, they're both great.
Yeah, yeah, so, they're fantastic.
Yeah. He's just, I don't know, Armin Shimerman's just, he is another actor who really got the character right out of the gate.
Yes, yeah, that's been my experience rewatching season one, is that you notice, you know, it takes a little while for René Auberjonois to find sort of the Odo voice and mannerisms, and that goes for a number of the characters. O'Brien is the one they really focus on a lot in season one, because it's all about, hey, there's that TNG crossover character. We got to get O'Brien in every episode possible. But it's really, Quark is just nailed down right from day one. Him and Kira are the two that feel really pretty hammered down right from the outset.
Well, Armin Shimerman, he said this at conventions before, but his entire goal with the Quark character was to redeem his first performance as a Ferengi back in Next Gen Season 1, where he's pretty much like a primate to a certain degree.
Do you think that was really his intention when he got hired for Deep Space Nine? Is that a story that sounds good now?
You know what? It's very curious because, Cam, you and I, we both watched Survivor.
Yeah.
And you can tell when the contestants get voted off and they go and do press interviews, they've had months to think about how to justify their actions.
Right,
and
yes,
you can tell a lot of what they say. It comes from hindsight, where as opposed to what actually was going on in the moment.
Right.
So, yes, I think maybe Armin Shimerman was happy to cash a check for 7 years, and it's very wonderful of him to tell the fans. But you know what? I felt bad about that initial portrayal of the Ferengi.
Yeah, like, I love that he's become kind of an advocate for the Ferengi and really emphasizing how important they are to the Star Trek universe and what they contribute. But I do feel like if you're in an episode that's maybe not that great in season one of TNG, you probably don't spend the next 5 years or 4 years or whatever really hemming and hawing about redeeming the Ferengi.
Yes.
No. It just seems unlikely to me.
That's true.
Especially for an actor who worked a fair amount.
Yeah. Well, so Cam, just any overall thoughts on Maquis parts one and two? Let me just ask you this. Does it justify itself as a two-part episode?
I think it does, because I think its mission is to establish the Maquis. I think one episode, it may have just been exposition overload with a very, very unsatisfying story kind of grafted onto it. I think this one, it has at least an involving tale involving Dukat and Sisko's relationship. There's some strong character dynamics. Does it end very well? No, I think the real issue with this is a two-parter is the Calvin Hudson storyline just kind of petering out in part two. And I think, you know, when we talked about TNG two-parters, that was often the case where an element would get dropped in the second half that we really cared about. I think Calvin Hudson is the, you know, is what happens in this one. That's where it goes wrong.
Well, I definitely would contend that part one is a much stronger episode. And that was one of the trends that we saw on Next Generation for the most part. Part one would be the stronger episode.
Yeah.
But this, I think that trend's still continuing. Even though you can tell that they had figured it out by the end of Next Generation that they would break the stories for parts one and two simultaneously, as opposed to just picking it up, 4 months later. So this, you can tell, the story's they knew where they were going here, but I still think that part one, I don't know, I was just, maybe it's just Decott saved it for me. But I would I say this justifies itself as a two-part episode? I think it could have taken some of the less interesting elements out of both parts and just mashed them all together into, I think, a stronger one-part episode that just follows maybe Ben and Decott on a mission to find Ben's old buddy who's, you know, messing with Cardassia.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay, well, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Well, you know, coming up, it's going to be the 20th anniversary of Star Trek First Contact.
My favorite Star Trek movie.
No, it's not, Cam. Why do you lie to our listeners? It's actually my favorite Star Trek film.
Yes.
So, you know, obviously we've reviewed this episode in the past. You can go download bonus episode number 8 if you want to hear our thoughts. We'll kind of provide a different sort of retrospective and maybe kind of talk about the legacy of Borg as antagonists. And they've been featured on every single series save for the original. Do you recall that they were featured on Emissary? So, of course, you do have a Borg episode on Deep Space Nine, too.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, we're just going to talk about their development and what, you know, First Contact adds to that picture and what was 1996, you know, peak Borg.
Right, I'm looking forward to actually revisiting the Enterprise episode. Because it's one that I actually enjoyed when I watched it. I'm curious to rewatch it now, having watched all of the TNG, all the Voyager, to kind of go back and watch that Enterprise episode.
We can get into it, because I think off-air you and I have discussed this one, and I think you're a much bigger fan of it than I am.
At least I was the first time around.
Okay.
It may change. That's why I'm really excited to revisit it.
Well, we'll fast forward 1 week, and we'll find out the real answer for that.
Sit on the edge of those seats, everyone.
Yes.
Okay, so you can also...
put on your sweatpants and run down that corridor. And...
work off that nervous energy. Yeah. You can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in vests, Smith.
Okay. You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N is Nicheev's irresponsible hothead.
Nice. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.